Last week we spoke about the life and the teaching of the Buddha, that he was from the Kshatriya class, that he was from a region in India which did not accept the superiority of the Brahmin priesthood, that the way of wisdom that he worked out was so effective that hundreds in his span of life, 80 years, were able to reach the fullness of realization that he offered in his path. They experienced nirvana, the blowing out of our pursuit of a limited self, a kind of fiction, because the self that we know, most of us, is simply constituted of natural elements which come into being through some process, persist for some time, and then pass away. And if that's what we are, then we have a certain ending. We persist by clinging to the sense of what we are. And this clinging leads us to pursue objects of desire, to pursue things that are evanescent in themselves, and to suffer as a result. It is often thought that Buddha taught primarily a path of meditation to lead to nirvana. And that, of course, has received a great deal of attention over the last couple of millenniums. But he also describes in the Te Vidya Sutta four boundless states which can lead one to this liberation that he described. Love, compassion, joy, equality. So that if you take these up as active stances in life, they dissolve this identity that we try to force upon this limited self we think ourselves to be. And nirvana is the result. This is not simply found in this particular sutta. It is also emphasized in the Metta Sutta, and it is verse 368 in the Dhammapada. So, in his lifetime, in these old Pali suttas, this was recorded from what he actually said and did. According to the nature of the person in front of him, he gave the instruction as to what would lead them to liberation from samsara. And as Richard Gombrich has noted in the last several years, if this teaching had been seen for what it is in the early times and not misunderstood, the whole development of Mahayana might not have been necessary. If they had understood that love is a doctrine that liberates as well as meditation. In fact, during the Buddha's life, there is no description of the four jhanas, the four states of meditation, which become so powerful an element of later Buddhist meditational approach. They are not there. But the fact is that the Buddha had, from his early years, some introduction to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad especially. And so in couching this teaching of love and compassion, which he gave to two young Brahman students who were coming to him for some advice as to how to attain the worlds of Brahman, because he spoke to them in ironic terms and with the understanding that, aha, I too know what you're talking about when you speak of Brahman, and I know this Upanishad that you're speaking of in the famous Five Fires section of the Brihadaranyaka, the other people in his camp, in Buddha's camp, who did not have that introduction to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, missed the note and reversed the teaching and said that those who practice love and compassion, etc., joy and equality, only get to the Brahman heavens and have to come back and work farther. And that is specifically not what Buddha said. He said, no, you will get to liberation. You will get beyond this conditioned state of being. You'll get beyond dependent origination. So I mentioned that just as an encouragement about how much love the Buddha must have had, as well as knowledge. He might have been a great general of spirituality in originating and organizing his renouncers. He may have seen the world as a field of suffering, but he knew that the experience that he was leading aspirants to was one of liberation, was one which annulled desire, which annulled suffering. So what is that state? He would not describe it. He was unorthodox. He did not accept the primacy of the Vedas. And now we turn to Sri Shankaracharya, Adinath Shankaracharya, who was an inheritor of the Vedic tradition, but himself strongly influenced by Buddhism, and so were his teachers. So let's do a little comparing and contrasting here. Since we've spent a whole evening just recently talking about the life of Shankara, I'm not going to go through the whole depiction of his biography, but let's set some facts down. Seems to have been born around the year 788. This is according to the tradition at the Sringari Math in South India. He was born in a village in what we call the Malabar coast, what is modern Kerala. He was apparently brilliant, may have been able to read by the age of 2 years old. Yes, they had reading and writing by then. He knew, they say, the whole of the Veda by the time he was either 4 or 8 years old, depending on which tradition you listen to. He was left with only his mother before he was 9 years old because his father died suddenly. His mother had to give him his sacred thread. This is a young boy who was, in a sense, already a repository of Vedic and spiritual knowledge, and so wanted to do what many were doing in the world then, that is to renounce the world and go away. And his mother said, you're my only son, I cannot let you go. Tradition has it that a crocodile near the river where his house was took him by the ankle one day and was dragging him into the river. And his mother was trying to free the boy. And he said, oh, mother, at least in these last moments of my life, give me permission to renounce the world so that I can become a true spiritual aspirant and look for better in my next life. And she gave him permission, and the crocodile released his leg. And Shankara said, guess what? So he did renounce the world at the age of 9 or 10 and went away to find his guru. He went north and found Govinda, whose own teacher was Gaudapada. And he gave him initiation. Shankara improved upon the teachings of his teacher and, in a sense, his spiritual grandfather, Gaudapada. Now, let's understand what the Vedic tradition consists of at this point. We've studied the Veda. We know the Rig Veda, the Yajur, the Saman, the Atharva. Also, there are the Upanishads attached to each of the Vedas. Now, in the early centuries BCE, say around 3rd or 4th century BCE, a number of sutras, short, concise sayings, are put together to, in a sense, establish the core of what the Upanishads taught. The Rig Veda might be too difficult to understand, might be ritualistically fixed, but the Upanishads are thought to capture the spiritual pith of what's at the center of the Vedic tradition. But the Upanishads are also numerous, and they have many teachings. So what is the core? So the Brahma Sutras come into being. And that, along with the Upanishads and later the Bhagavad Gita, come to form the corpus of what we call the Vedantic tradition. This is what people can really work with. This is supposed to be understandable. The problem is that the Brahma Sutras are almost impenetrable. They're written so compactedly that you can get several interpretations from every sentence. So Gaudapada had written a commentary only years before Shankara arrived at this place. And this commentary reveals strong influence from the Buddhist Mahayana teachings. The terminology, the very logical forms that are used, are all reminiscent of Buddhism. But where Buddhism described a world of suffering built up from elements which we know not where they come from or where they're going, give up that metaphysical quest. You'll never get to that. Try to absolve yourself from connection to it. Realize nirvana. Now Gaudapada says only Brahman is real. And this world, instead of being a world of suffering, is a world of illusion. This becomes a primary plank in Shankara's philosophy and approach. Shankara writes an early commentary at the age of 12 years old on Brahma Sutra, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and goes off to defeat and debate the greatest enemy that he felt there was to this teaching of the eternal Brahman. And that was not Buddhism, but he goes after the Mimamsaka school, which were This was a school of ritualism which believed in the efficacy of the ritual and that only the material world counted. So he leaps, literally climbs into the household of the greatest Mimamsaka teacher of the day, and leaps as a youth, 12 years old, into this camp. And Mandana looks at him and says, "Where has this shaven head come from?" And the boy retorts, "Well, you're pretty stupid. Obviously, it comes from the neck." So they start jibing and taunting at each other until finally Shankara has drawn Mandana into the agreement of a debate. And they debate, some say for 3 days, some say for 16 days. And Mandana's wife is to be the judge of who is the victor. And I'll spare you the gory details, but the young boy defeats the Mimamsaka teacher, and he becomes Shankara's disciple. And then he begins to consolidate. He goes from village to village. This is called his Digvijaya. Digvijaya is a term that military and kings used to talk about a victorious romp across the countryside, carrying victory everywhere they went, defeating every enemy. But now the enemy is not somebody in military combat, rather it's in intellectual debate. And Shankara, even at the age of 12, cannot be defeated. Just as Buddha, nearly 1,000 years before, could never be bested in debate, so is Shankara, but his logic is even more sharp. If you go back and read the Brihadaranyaka commentary, his gloss, his bhashya, or what he's written on the Brahma Sutras, you get something. I think I sent to you this wonderful work, Viveka Chudamani, which is Crest Jewel of Discrimination. This is a work that's original to him, and while it sets out wonderful aphorisms, it doesn't have the logical consistency of what he did in these earlier glosses. So if you want to see him at his sharpest, you have to go read those. But you can see even in this, Viveka Chudamani. First, he's approached by a seeker who wants to know what is the path to knowledge, who presents to him 7 questions. Shankara takes up the 4th question first, and then the 5th, and then the 6th, and only then takes up the others. He reverses the order, because the first thing that he wants to do is show you the path to liberation. To liberate us from what? To liberate us from what? We have to understand what we are and what we are not. We have to see what we are and what we are not. There is a reality and there is an appearance. To understand the nature of reality requires us to look beyond the apparent. We see in the murky shadows of dusk something stretched out on the road in the distance, and it looks to us like a snake. And we're afraid. We take that snake to be real. We want to walk around it. We want to avoid it. It's only if we get closer to it that we see it's not a snake. It's just a rope. This is a cardinal mistake that we make when we look at the world. When we look at the world, we see one thing when really it's another. We see diversity. Shankara says, and if you don't mind, I'm going to, instead of sticking to the logic of the Viveka Chudamani, just present the gist of what he's trying to tell us. If we look at the world, we see a multiplicity. We see many things. We see many selves. Shankara takes as an absolute that the Shruti, the received teachings, the heard teachings of the Vedic tradition are real. The Upanishad says Brahman is real and is eternal. He takes that as an absolute, a basis for all else. If Brahman is an absolute, then it cannot be in time. It cannot be a thing or many things. Because if you look at anything, that thing comes into being and passes out of being in the scope of time. But if Brahman is beyond time, then there is no expanse of time in which something can arise and fall away in being. So whatever it is that we're seeing, it cannot be that reality. Brahman is beyond time. It is beyond space. It is a reality that has no particular name. It has no particular form. If we take clay and we bake the clay after shaping it into the form of a pot, we look at that and we say, that is a pot. But what it more fundamentally is clay. If you break it, then the pot is gone. Where is that pot? The clay remains. The clay can be mixed up again, recycled, reused, and it comes back in a different form. What has persisted is the substratum. What has disappeared is the thing that appeared to be real. Disappeared. And just so, when we look at the world, we think we see something moving. But if the real reality is what is timeless and absolute, then this world that we see must be like that snake. It really is a rope, and we are interpreting the terms of the apparent conditioning of the world as being genuine. We are making a fundamental mistake. So, there's another kind of illusion. What if there is a conch, a white conch shell? And we take a pane of glass, which is yellow in covering, and we look at that conch shell through that glass. We think whatever it is on the other side, it's got to be yellow. But if we get a different vantage, if we're able to step away from that yellow pane of glass and see it, we can see, all along, it was really white. It wasn't yellow. It was really white. Or what I thought was white was really yellow. But that thing is there. That thing is more like what we are. It really was there, but there was an imposition. There was something standing between, an upadhi, to stand between the reality and the perceiver. What is true in all cases was the perceiver. Shankara says, the one thing you can never doubt is the reality of your own being. But the being that you think you are isn't what you see. And now Shankara refers back and says, when you look at what you think is the composition of the world or the composition of yourself, using the terminology of the Sankhya, it's back. All of this is constructed externalities. You are not that. What you are is an unpartite self, an Atman, which is the same thing as saying Brahman. There is no difference. So the distinction between self and Brahman does not count. He said, but there is not the same relation between Brahman and world. The self, the core of the self, is real. We just need to drop the things that we think identify us with the body, with the life, with the mind, and then we realize what we are, essential spirit, one with Brahman. Or is Brahman, because there are no two to become one with. But if you look at the world is not real in the same way that the self is real. And so he says, Brahman Satyam, Jagat Nityam. Brahman is truth. That is what is true. The world is a lie. It's not an illusion. He doesn't say it's an illusion. He says it's a lie. He says it is neither real nor unreal. He doesn't say that the world is an unreality, but he says it is neither nor. So that thing which you know not to be nor not to be. Does that make sense? Step away from that and realize what is fundamental. So look at your states of your awareness. Look at the things that cover over this essential reality that you are. There's this gross anamaya kosha. There's this gross physical body made of food. Comes into being, passes away. Seems to. There's the pranamaya kosha. There's this life body. There's manomaya kosha. There's this mental body. There's the anandamaya kosha, the vijnanamaya kosha. All of these, as brilliant as they may be, none of them are really what you are. So the only thing that you must recognize is that you are, without dependence on bliss or supreme knowledge or mental awareness or vital power or bodily fixity. This thing exists beyond all of this and is Brahman. Atman is Brahman. So how do we get there? If the world seems to be in front of us, he said, accept it as a conditioned, a kind of representation of what the infinite and eternal Brahman is. If this world that you seem to be part of can be used for anything, use it as an expression of Saguna Brahman. It is here through the power of Maya, through the power of illusion. It is not really here because only Brahman the Eternal really exists. It is the only reality. And you can't say that it is one. He, Shankara, denies the many but does not affirm the one. He simply leaves that unexplained, as Buddha left that undescribed also. And our passage into this may be graced by what we would call Ishvara, a Supreme Lord, but that Lord at some point, because it is not real, will confer upon us the liberating knowledge that carries us even beyond the Saguna and the world of Ishvara into the unconditioned Brahman beyond. The passage by which we get there first demands of us a code of conduct that begins to turn our lives towards that. And then it asks us to listen well to the teachings of a guru, asks us to think deeply about it. Sramana, that's not it. And manana, and finally nididhyasana, which is meditation. Meditation finally leads to the insight that cuts behind this apparent world and apparent self to that which truly is. So, Shankara establishes that the Upanishads tell us the truth about the nature of reality. And we must find the teacher who understands the Shruti, who understands this Vedic tradition, and not only has that understanding of the teaching, but who has realized it, who stands upon Brahman constantly. And that person has to give us initiation and push us along until we can attain this liberation from a cessational world. That is moksha. And Shankara assembles an army of seekers. He establishes mutts, great ashramas, at four different points in India. In the south, Sringeri. In the west, at Dwarka. In the north, at Bandri. In the east, at Puri. And the oldest of these, the Sringeri mutt, has not seen any interruption in its lineage since, I think, the third generation from Shankara, and has actually kept wonderful records up to this present day. The others have had some interruptions. These are renouncers of the world who are called ekadandis, those who carry the one staff. Different from others who also carry staffs, like those who carry the trident representing Shiva, etc. So now this tradition, which is over 1,000 years old, parampara that is carried on, transmitted from generation to generation with one Shankaracharya after another taking over the helm to lead the monastery forward at all these four great mutts in India, continue to be the strongest champions for a pure Indian philosophy anywhere. The logic which was built up after Shankara has been greatly sharpened and sophisticated, and has been often identified with a Shaiva orientation towards Shiva, where the subsequent school, which gave debate to Shankara's teachings, which instead of being absolute in its Vedanta, has a qualified approach to reality, was established by Ramanuja, who was a Vaishnava, a devotee of Vishnu. So even though Shankara says, no, we are beyond identification with any god or any personality, he is also credited with having written some of the most wonderful hymns to Shankara that exist in mellifluous Sanskrit, by the way. His Sanskrit is magnificent. It's great poetry. So, I should mention to you in this context that Robert and Jan Kleinman in 1969 and 70 went to live in India for a year, and they stayed in a town right next to the Sringari Math, the oldest and greatest of the Shankaracharya Maths in South India, in part because Bob wanted to be able to go over and talk philosophy with them in the Math, and also because it was, at least on the map, close to Pondicherry. Still a very difficult trip to be able to get to Pondicherry. So he and Jan spent the whole year in Sringari. She adjusted wonderfully. She loved India. She loved the heat, the climate, the food, the people, the dress. When she wore a sari, she looked like a North Indian lady. Hmm. And if I may, when she went to see the mother in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, and she was climbing the stairs to go and see her, she suddenly burst into tears. She didn't know why. She wept and wept and wept and continued to weep when she came out and was sitting in the car to go back to her guest house. She still was weeping. And mother, when she met her, just smiled, recognized her, and Jan's good friends there in the ashram, Amal Kiran and Arindam Basu, said, oh, what mother has done is stirred awake the psychic being in you and brought it to the front. And it was so. Jan lived in a felicitous psychic consciousness. Much of the time she was in Pondicherry, floating into it, coming out of it, but always that sense of felicity and peace that is present when the soul is near was there in her. I think Mother wanted Jan to stay in the ashram, but Bob had not had quite so brilliant an experience in India, and he was anxious to return to America. And Jan, bless her heart, agreed to come back to the States with him. So it is. I was able to meet them, oh, I don't know, a year later. And Jan taught me how to drink green tea, gave me my first pieces of Asian art, gave me my first lesson in spicy cooking so that Daryl Morey and I could sustain ourselves in our studies in Tallahassee. She was a friend and an elegant representative of beauty and aspiration. She got her master's in fine arts in the field of Asian art, especially. Drew and painted herself, did lots of wonderful photography. I've still got many of her pieces that she shared with me. And in these last years, she has borne gracefully the process of deterioration that detaches the soul from the body. And in fact, this afternoon, just before 4 p.m., she left her body. So my dear friend Jan no longer has to suffer the slow disintegration, the slow suffocation of losing one's life force. She is on her way to great felicity. She'll rest for a bit, and she'll be back. Our work here, as much as we think we've done, has hardly begun. So I ask you this evening if you will share some of the love and the light that you possess with her and wish her well and offer her a boost as she moves beyond to those other shores. Jan, mother's daughter, Jai Ma. Well, I want to give you the chance to ask any questions that you may have. So.